Caring for a loved one who's suffering at the end of life can be a terrible ordeal, and many people feel like we need more options. Today, the debate over aid in dying. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. National polls show that a slim majority of Americans would like to see laws that allow aid in dying, sometimes called physician-assisted suicide. Polls also show that only a third of doctors are in favor. This hour, we'll explore the issue with a native Iowan who's the executive director of the Death with Dignity National Center, a doctor, an ethicist, and a registered nurse with extensive experience with hospice and palliative care. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. There are a lot of different names for it. Euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, and aid in dying are the most common. National polls show that approximately 55% of Americans would like to see laws that allow it, but polls also show that only a third of doctors are in favor. This hour, we'll explore the issue with guests who have a diverse set of views, and we also want to hear your thoughts this hour. You can email talkofiowa at iowapublicradio.org. Aid in dying, a physician-assisted death, is legal in Washington, Montana, and Vermont. It has been legal in Oregon for nearly 20 years. Peg Sandin is the executive director of the Death with Dignity National Center in Oregon. She's a native Iowan who became an advocate for aid in dying through a very personal experience. Hello, Peg.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, I am happy to join you.
And I want to go back to a very difficult time in your life, and that is the death of your husband. Can you tell me what happened?
Yes, I can. It was a very long time ago. I met my husband when I was in college, and we got married a couple years after I graduated from college. And that very first year, we got a phone call saying that he was, from his ex-wife, saying that he was HIV positive. And so at that time, so long ago, HIV was a death sentence, and it was for him. And he experienced a very debilitating illness and a very, very difficult death at a very young age.
When your husband was dying, did you have the thought then that you wished there was something else you could do for him?
You know, I didn't have the thought. Again, I was so young. I was 25 years old. Dying wasn't a part of my lexicon necessarily. I didn't anticipate it was going to happen to my husband at that time when we were so young. But he definitely had that thought that he was so debilitated and his suffering was so great that he had hoped that there was something that he could do to hasten his death.
How did you become involved with the Right to Death with Dignity movement then?
You know, I think that it really was that early young exposure to sort of a protracted dying experience or a very long and very difficult suffering-filled dying experience that I felt like medicine needed to offer an alternative. I felt like medicine kept him alive, and modern medical technology kept him alive far beyond sort of a natural state. And so I had this commitment when I was very young to try and do something about this, to try and address the situation that I thought was unfair and very difficult for families.
And I mentioned there are so many different names for this and different ideas of what it means to allow a physician to aid a patient in dying. Can you tell me specifically what you're advocating for?
You bet. I am. The things that I advocate for are a state sanctioning of this policy, because what we know is that physicians help patients die in every state all over our country every day. And what we've said in Oregon and in Washington and Vermont is that we need a state-sanctioned process. We need a standard of care, a medical standard of care that physicians have to follow. And so it's not sort of this in the back halls of the hospitals happening. It's not sort of untalked about how we do it. In Oregon, Washington, and Vermont, what we advocate for is a process that physicians have to follow when a patient requests assistance in dying.
And I know this has been the law of the land in Oregon for nearly 20 years. What is the process there? How does it work?
So what happens is a patient who is terminally ill goes to his or her physician and says, I want help with the hastened death, or I want to take advantage of death with dignity. And that patient has to go through a series of many steps to qualify to receive a medication. And the reason why we have those steps is that they are safeguards. They protect against coercion. And so some of the safeguards that a patient has to do is the patient has to make 2 oral requests and 1 written request. So a patient has to make 3 requests for this medication. The patient has to be an adult. He or she has to be determined to be mentally competent. So the person can't be so depressed that they can't make healthcare decisions. They have to be a resident of Oregon. They have to be terminally ill, and that terminal illness has to be determined by 2 different physicians. So prognosis and diagnosis have to be determined by 2 different physicians. There have to be witnesses to the written request, and there's 2 different waiting periods that a patient has to go through. And these are all the things that a person has to go through just to qualify.
Now, of course, when a patient is diagnosed with a terminal illness, in many cases, there is a period of time. Sometimes it's short, sometimes it's very long between that diagnosis and the point at which a patient might decide that the quality of life is so poor that they don't want to continue. So how is that taken into account?
So the 2 physicians both have to determine that the patient's diagnosis or the illness, the terminal illness that they have, will lead to death within 6 months. And so the person who is terminally ill, when those 2 physicians say that that is the case, then he or she qualifies to receive a medication if the person passes through all the safeguards. But as you suggest, that doesn't mean that the person takes that medication right then, right? Working with patients in Oregon, what we know is that people wait until the very last minute when their suffering is so great to hasten their death.
Now, a lot of people talk about the immense amount of pain and suffering that people who are dying of, for example, Alzheimer's experience there at the end of life. But it sounds like this law would not allow them to receive medication because they would not be mentally competent to ask for that medication.
That is correct. And also, I mean, the other component of that is when a person who's diagnosed with Alzheimer's has mental capacity to request the medication, he or she probably doesn't have a terminal diagnosis, right? Because the Alzheimer's wouldn't lead to death in 6 months. So there's 2 facets of that condition.
Since this law has been in place now for so long, what do we know about the consequences? What do we know about the survivors of people who have chosen this kind of death?
There was a study recently undertaken by physicians here at a medical school called OHSU, which is a big medical school in Portland, Oregon. And the physician researchers looked at people who were survivors, whose family members who had taken death with dignity medication to hasten their death, and compared them to people with similar conditions, similar diagnoses, who had died but who had not hastened their death. And they found in the comparison that there was no difference in terms of bereavement time, in terms of adjustment, in terms of processing their loved one's death when you compared the two groups. So what research shows us is that death with dignity doesn't have a negative effect on the survivors.
Do you feel like there are things about this law that you would change if you could?
You know, it's interesting. I'm a social worker. I got my MSW at the University of Iowa. I have a PhD in social work, and I teach policy, sort of how states enact policy. And one of the very fascinating things about the Death with Dignity Act that was written, and it was the first in the world type of legislation written 20 years ago, and the authors got it right. One of the things that they did is they held many, many focus groups of Oregonians, different opponents, proponents, family members, terminally ill individuals, physicians, lawyers, pharmacists. They held these focus groups all across the state to write this first in the world type of legislation, and they got it right the first time. If you think about laws that are written all around the country in state legislatures and by Congress, getting it right the first time is so unusual. But in Oregon, they did.
There are a lot of people who are very concerned about the fear that laws like this would allow euthanasia, the killing of someone who is not ready to go, that somehow this law could be abused to end someone's life because the family doesn't want to care for them, or any number of different scenarios. Have there been, to your knowledge, instances of abuse in Oregon?
No, there have not. We have 17 years of data, so the state of Oregon is required under the Oregon Death with Dignity Act to examine the data and to give a report to the people of Oregon about how the law is used. And there has been not one case of coercion or euthanasia in the state, nor has there been in Washington since Washington enacted the law. And I will say that those sorts of activities are banned under the Oregon Death with Dignity Act. It's a felony to coerce someone into using the law.
And you mentioned that for someone to take advantage of the law, they need to be a citizen of Oregon. Have you had people moving to Oregon to be able to take advantage of this law?
You know, one of the early arguments against the Oregon Death with Dignity Act is that people would rush to Oregon, or Oregon would become a death destination where people move here to end their lives, perhaps on our beaches, our beautiful Pacific Ocean beaches, and that has just not happened. People who are terminally ill cannot leave there. It is too hard to move. It just does not happen.
Peg, thank you so much. And I want you to stay on the line. I'm going to spend some time talking with a couple of other guests with very different perspectives on this, but then we'll bring you back into the conversation later in the hour. Thank you, Peg.
Yes, thank you.
Peg Sandine is the executive director of the Death with Dignity National Center in Oregon. We'll be talking with her later. Coming up next, a conversation with a doctor, an ethicist, and then later on, a registered nurse who has extensive experience with hospice and palliative care. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about aid in dying, physician-assisted suicide, euthanasia. There are a lot of different terms for it, and there are a lot of different feelings about it across the nation. I've been talking with the director of the Death with Dignity campaign in Oregon. Now we're going to get a different perspective. With me is Dr. Loris Kaljan. He's director of the program in bioethics and humanities at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. He's also a professor in the Department of Internal Medicine. Dr. Kaljan, thank you so much for being here today.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
And as I pointed out earlier, national polls are showing that approximately 55% of the general public would like to see some sort of law that provides an opportunity for physician-assisted death. Only about a third of physicians feel the same way. As a physician, what are your main concerns about this kind of legislation, this kind of opportunity?
That's a great question, and there are many, actually, to this very complex, very personal, very professional, very social question. And I very much appreciate how people like your first guest, Peg Sandine, and so many others in Iowa and elsewhere have many stories to tell about how difficult the dying process can be and how much suffering there is. And so the first thing I think all physicians would want to say, regardless of which side of the issue they may fall on, is that we want to be able to respond to any such requests, any such concerns, to explore them, to understand what's beneath them. I would say that if one looks historically at this question, one has to acknowledge that there has been, for not just decades or hundreds, but thousands of years, a respect for human life that serves as a pillar, as a boundary to what physicians do or don't do. And even one of the first times this came up as an issue was back at the time of Hippocrates. People, your listeners will have heard of the so-called Hippocratic Oath, in which it says that we will not give medicines to people to help them end their lives. And at that time, the majority vote was actually that sort of thing was being done. So these controversies are not at all new, and I think that's some, in a certain sense, encouraging, and in a certain sense, sobering. But this basic respect for life is the fundamental pillar, so that if one ever thinks about intentionally causing death or hastening death, one has crossed that boundary into a different terrain.
Now, Peg was saying that doctors aid patients in dying everywhere. And, of course, we were talking about the places in which it's legal. I assume she was talking about the possibility that a doctor could give pain medication that would also hasten death, but also lessen the pain that the patient is feeling.
Right. There was a certain ambiguity in the way that that was said, suggested, and I certainly want to say, yes, the good news is that doctors, especially palliative care doctors, they aid patients, thankfully, all the time in the dying process. But if what was meant by that statement was that covert forms of assisted suicide are happening throughout Iowa and the rest of the country, you'd have to look at whatever empirical data are available to support that conclusion. But I think one has to be cautious about making those sorts of claims. But what I would rather say is the good news is that there are forms of assistance in the dying process that focus on comfort rather than intentionally trying to hasten or cause death.
Now, I understand that you personally are opposed to this, and your Christian beliefs are a large part of that. But let's take a hypothetical. Let's say you were a doctor practicing in Oregon, and you were asked to help someone end their life. What are the fears that come to your mind in playing out that scenario?
Well, there are many. That, you know, at the level excuse me, of the patient, one of the first questions that I would have is, so what's behind that? And there are empirical data from at least one study in Oregon that showed one of the top five reasons for patients who request assisted suicide is not uncontrollable pain. I find that to be quite fascinating because early on in the debates in this country, the possibility of uncontrollable pain is what drove a lot of the advocacy for this. But rather, it has to do with issues such as wanting to control the time and place of one's death, having perceptions about human dignity such that one believes that one's dying process doesn't have dignity. Sometimes patients are concerned about being a burden on their loved ones. There are many features to this that are of a sort that I would consider profoundly existential and personal. And if a patient has to come to a physician to get permission through the prescription of an overdose of medicine to go through with this, they are depending on another human being. They're not simply asking for the right to be left alone. Good palliative care also includes the right to be left alone, to not be intervened upon. But now they're asking for another human being to basically affirm and say that there's a rational response that could include the decision to commit suicide through an overdose of medication. So I would have a whole host of questions for the patient, but that I would also say, do you realize that it takes two to tango in this matter, that you're also depending upon another human being's assessment upon whether your life is worth living, etc.?
There was an article published earlier this year by public radio host Diane Rehm, who hosts a national program, The Diane Rehm Show, and she wrote a very personal essay about her husband's death. And he had Parkinson's disease, and as things continued, he was more and more uncomfortable, more and more in pain, less able to do anything independently. And they had an understanding between the two of them that they would do whatever they could to ease the pain. And if that involved hastening death, that would be a part of it. However, they were in a place where that was not legal. His doctor felt he could do nothing And so her husband chose to die of thirst, to die of dehydration, and had to, over a period of days, not take fluids. And there was pain medication to ease his pain. But she writes with a great feeling about how helpless she felt, how difficult it was to watch her husband suffer, and why she believes there should be a law to allow a physician to assist in death in a situation like that. And if you had a patient in that condition, what would you do?
I would do what medicine, I believe, tries to do, and that is to say that the fundamental purpose of medicine is not to eliminate all suffering. That's not the purpose of medicine. It's to maximize care. And for Diane Rehm or others to say that their physician said there's nothing they can do, that's never true. There's always things that we can do. And in fact, in some of the most intensive forms of palliative care, medicines can be used to treat symptoms, whether of pain or of nausea or of seizures. Any of these kinds of things can be controlled with medications. Sometimes, though, we recognize that it means that someone's level of alertness will be compromised. But medicine has always things to do if people are there to be practicing medicine properly.
Do you feel that there should be more options for a physician in that situation? I mean, obviously, no matter what the personal beliefs are of the physician, there is also the fear of breaking the law. Should there be more options?
I believe that palliative care has plenty of options. I think if one crosses the boundary towards saying that now we want to socially sanction and authorize the medical profession to be in the practice of intentionally causing or hastening or assisting death, that we have crossed a line that also has implications. And I think we should not be naive about the impact this can also have on medical professionals. Medical professionals have expertise, but that doesn't mean they are all powerful, especially in a self-disciplined sort of way. Doctors have fears of death. Doctors have frustrations in caring for patients who are dying. They don't like to watch people suffer either. There can be many reasons why you could suggest that if you basically say society now empowers doctors to take on this role, that over time, even though the initial changes may be subtle, there can be attitudinal shifts in healthcare providers that now possibly even would lead to assisted suicide not just being an option, but potentially shifting towards being, at least in some cases, a recommendation. And that shows that the emphasis on patient self-determination and freedom and autonomy is only part of the story. Shared decision-making between physicians and other healthcare professionals and patients is always a dialogue, and there will be influences from both sides.
So you're concerned about the weight that would place on the shoulders of the physician, which there are already a lot of heavy weights on the shoulders of a physician. But you're also concerned about the possibilities for abuse. What are your fears there?
Well, certainly many human beings are vulnerable. In one sense, we're all vulnerable to some degree, especially when we're in the dying process. And there are many different internal and external potential coercions that can exist. And I think that given the way that those kinds of pressures can bear down upon people, to say that someone is simply expressing their individual freedom as a human being to say, I would like this and I ought to have access to this through a medicalized process, I think has to be taken in a fuller context. And remember once again that in things like do not resuscitate orders and withholding and withdrawing of life-sustaining treatments in current practices of medicine, there people are given the freedom to be left alone. But that is different than now asking for the assistance to be enabled to do something that actually, even by law, is not against the law. Committing suicide, attempting to, is not illegal, though it used to be. And so in that sense, we have to keep in mind that now advocates for this are asking to medicalize suicide in a way that makes it socially approved and facilitated. And that's a distinct request.
I'm talking to Dr. Loris Kaljan. He's director of the program in bioethics and humanities at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. He's also a professor in the Department of Internal Medicine. And I want to now bring Lori Bishop into the conversation. She is executive director for clinical transformation at Unity Point at Home in Des Moines, and she has 22 years of experience working in hospice and palliative care. Hello, Lori.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
And Lori, with your experience, have you had patients ask you to help them die?
Yes, I have had patients ask me that, and I have engaged in deeper conversation when they ask those things to understand what their fears are, what their concerns are. You know, palliative care and hospice is a team-based care. So we look at a whole person, not just their medical needs, but their emotional, their spiritual, their psychosocial needs. I've had one individual in particular that I remember quite well who had really wanted that option and was disappointed that we weren't able to provide that. And yet later when he was very imminent in his death within days, he thought that I was killing him based on our previous conversation and or was assisting him to die, and he no longer wanted that option. So that actually created a complication for us to provide that reassurance that we were not doing anything to hasten his death. I've also seen people say, you know, they couldn't live this way or didn't want to live if this happened. And when they get to those plateaus, again, depending on the symptom management and the emotional and psychosocial and spiritual support they have, they find that they can handle those things that when they were in a different state of being, they didn't think they could. So that's been the bulk of my experience with that.
And I guess we should define here, as we're talking about these terms, hospice and palliative care. Hospice is end-of-life care, and your goal is to make a patient as comfortable as possible. Palliative care is slightly different, but has also, you are not trying to cure a patient, but to manage a disease or a condition that cannot be cured.
Right. Palliative care is really about, it can be at any stage in an illness. So even at the time of diagnosis, I think of palliative care as really, you know, goals of care discussions, advanced care planning, aggressive symptom management, but really on that individual's terms, understanding what matters most to them and their quality of life and what their concerns are and helping them look at the different options, including not doing anything, and understanding what that might mean. And then hospice, as you say, is a subset of palliative care, and it is for people with less than 6 months to live.
And Lori, you mentioned patients talking to you about their concerns. What are the concerns that you hear? Is it a fear of pain, or what are some of the things that they talk to you about when they think about the end of life?
It is. Most people are not afraid of dying. They're afraid of the process of dying. What will that look like? How will I feel? It is a loss of control concern. It's a loss of dignity in some cases, but it's mainly that loss of control, suffering, and then burden. So usually when we can have those conversations and talk about what the options might be when they get to those points, and create a plan of care that they are very much in the driver's seat with, usually we can relieve a lot of that.
Now, you have personal experience. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you've seen many people go through this transition, but you've also lost your father, mm-hmm. and his last days were very difficult.
Mm-hmm. They were. He actually had dementia. My father worked until he was 82, and then he had to retire because of his dementia. He spent the last 4 months of his life, two of those in an assisted living, and then he transferred to a nursing home. Certainly not something he would have chosen. He was in hospice care, but he really wasn't you wouldn't necessarily assume that he had less than 6 months to live. But we appreciated hospice following him on that journey, and really it was our way of being able to honor his wishes and not seek aggressive treatment. So when he had a sudden change in condition, it took several days for him to die. And, you know, I could appreciate that time because it really gave time for my siblings to come to terms, and eventually everyone got there. Originally, several did not want to come, but they ended up coming, and there was a lot of healing and closure in those days that we might not have had. It wasn't easy for the family to watch, but he really was peaceful. I would say from my experiences professionally that he was comfortable. I wouldn't say that everyone in my family would have the same perception of that process, but there was a lot of work done in our family during those days.
And according to the death with dignity laws that are in place in some states, your father would not have qualified for aid in dying anyway. But after we get back from a break, I want to talk more with you about how that informs your thoughts about this issue. We also want to open up the phones. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me is Lori Bishop. She's Executive Director for Clinical Transformation for Unity Point at Home in Des Moines. And we'll bring back into the conversation Dr. Loris Kaljan and Peg Sandeen, and we'd love to hear from you as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about choices at the end of life. There are many people in this country and in this state who are in favor of having a legal opportunity for physicians to aid a patient in dying. Some people call it physician-assisted suicide. Some people call it euthanasia. Aid in dying is another term. We want to hear your thoughts. Join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Peg Sandeen is with us. She's Executive Director of the Death with Dignity National Center in Oregon. Dr. Loris Kaljan is here, Director of the Program in Bioethics and Humanities at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. He's also a professor in the Department of Internal Medicine. And Lori Bishop, Executive Director for Clinical Transformation for Unity Point at Home in Des Moines. And Lori, before we open up the floor to everybody, I want to ask you just a little bit more. We were talking about the difficult death of your father, and I wonder how that informs your opinions about whether or not this should be a legal avenue that people could pursue at the end of life.
Well, as I mentioned before the break, I think there was some good healing for my family that occurred in those days while my dad was dying. So I don't think we would have had those days if we would have gone a different route. And I don't think we can always appreciate some of the things that come out of those times of suffering. I think the emphasis here to me is more about we should be supporting the conversations. We should be supporting the ability for physicians to take the time needed to have these conversations with patients. My dad and I had several conversations because of the work that I did, and I felt very confident in knowing what his wishes were at end of life. But I don't know that he had that same conversation and relationship with his physician. And I think that's where we need to really focus the energy here, is on those conversations and documents like physician-ordered scope of treatment, which allows for individuals to list what they want at the end of life and what they don't want. So it's not just about what you don't want to happen, but also what you do. And I think that's an excellent movement that's happening nationally and in each state. And I'd like to see that really spread, because I think that helps the whole family when you have those kind of conversations.
When I think about this issue, I think it's very interesting that in this country, there are many people who euthanize their beloved pets at the end of their lives, that don't want to see their pets go through a painful end. And that has become commonplace. Obviously, not everybody chooses to go that route. But I am curious, when we think about that fact of life in this country, how do you think that relates to this issue, Lori?
Well, our pets can't talk to us. They can't tell us what's going on. And I think that we don't always go to the extremes of figuring out what's going on medically with a pet when they get to that point. I've also been through that actually with my pet and got to that point. But I think it's, you know, we're not animals, we're humans. We have reasoning, we have emotion, we have the ability to communicate. And I think, again, if we would have these conversations when we're well and start them there, and have them as we get diagnosed with chronic illnesses or serious illnesses, and just that they become commonplace, not only with our families, but with our physicians, I think that would make a big difference. But I don't know that I would compare it. I don't think we should compare humans to dogs, but...
Well, I want an opportunity now to allow the three of you to talk with each other and interact. We also would love to hear from you if you have thoughts on this issue at 866-780-9100. Marcia is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Marcia.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I just want to say first off that your physician from University of Iowa is absolutely on target.
All right. So,
yeah, we don't want to medicalize this issue. This is something that's going to happen.
And this is an opinion that you've come to through a long career in healthcare.
Yes, I got to retire, thank goodness. But now that I'm on the other side of the fence and receive healthcare, it certainly is eye-opening as well. But to address this issue ahead of time is crucial, to address these issues ahead of crisis. And to just be able to talk about death is really important in our culture. It's a new thing. Death is not an illness. It's not illegal. It's not failure. It's not a competition. It's something that's going to occur. And this view that it has to be a doctor that performs this death ritual or a special place where people go to have it happen is kind of strange to me. I think that the person who may be in the best position to evaluate what's appropriate for death care is someone who's seen a lot of death. And I don't mean violent death, but death in medical situations.
And, Marcia, do you think that there should be more options available? You don't want to see this medicalized, but do you feel that there should be more options available at the end of life?
I think that any option a person wants, perhaps, should be available. I think most people are pretty reasonable. But these options are already available, and they are being used. And it's a shame we have to legalize death.
Well, Marcia, thank you so much for your thoughts. And Dr. Calgin, I'll give you an opportunity to respond to what Marcia was saying.
This is a profound question that Marcia is raising. And there are certainly some people who would say that, yes, there are other means that people can take into their own hands, shall we say. And that's a very difficult thing to talk about, and one can sound all too insensitive or callous even by saying that, and that's certainly not my intention. But if the state of Iowa or any other state wanted to come up with some non-physician means of doing this, that's the state of Iowa's prerogative. And one thing also to keep in mind here is to remember that this question of the so-called right to die rose to the level of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1997. And as we all know, it's rare that the Supreme Court ever has a unanimous decision. Well, they had one this time. And it was a 9-0 vote against the constitutional right to die. But what that did was gave states permission to do as they see fit on this question. So far, it has taken a medicalized context, but it need not do so. And if it didn't take that direction, at least that would protect the medical profession from taking those steps.
And Peg, I'd love to hear your response as well. Marcia was saying that maybe reading through the lines there a little bit, that there are options available to people, that, that people are exercising. But it strikes me that a lot of people don't feel like they have options.
That is correct. A lot of people struggle with those options. A lot of the things that I feel like Marcia was bringing up and addressing are very complex, but there's one thing that I really wanted to draw our attention to. When she talked about the best person to make the decision, she said, is a person who has experienced a lot of people dying, suggesting that it's the healthcare. We believe that the best person to make the decision is the person who is dying, that he or she is the only person that truly knows what is best for him or her. And so I really think that what we've done in Oregon is we've created an extra option for those people, a very small number, fewer than 100 or 110 of year per year in the state of Oregon, who are suffering greatly.
Now, I read an article not that long ago that was written by a doctor, and it was about how doctors choose to die. And one of the things that it said in the article is that most doctors, when they make their wishes known, do not want extreme measures taken to extend their lives. There are a lot of them who choose to have a do not resuscitate order, and they don't want to go through some of these procedures that are really very common in trying to extend people's lives. And I guess, Lori, I'd like to get your response to that. If people who know a lot about dying and have seen a lot of people receive health care at the end of their life are choosing not to have life-extending procedures taken, what does that say about our end-of-life care in this country?
Well, I would be one of those people, actually, that feels that way. But I think it's really because I think you're shifting a focus. You know, just to be kept alive for the sake of saying you're alive isn't necessarily quality of life. And so, and sometimes pain and suffering is added to when we're just trying to keep someone alive instead of, you know, focusing on symptom management and quality of life. So, and in fact, studies show that people who choose quality of life over quantity oftentimes actually live longer because they're focused on the quality of their life. They're feeling better, their symptoms are well managed, then they actually live longer than those that are seeking aggressive treatments, that sometimes actually the treatments can hasten your life. But I think that's not, I don't know if that's a fair comparison with a law allowing people, you know, to have physicians provide them with lethal doses. That's not quite the same thing. And I think that's really where this conversation should start, though, is with what do you want? What does quality of life mean to you? And, you know, it's not a one-time conversation because your life changes, your perspective changes. You know, what was important to me at 20 is not necessarily what's important to me at age 55. So it's got to be a lifelong conversation that we have. And we have to acknowledge that people do have a right to choose. They have a right to choose aggressive treatment. They have a right to choose alternative treatments. And they also need to have informed consent to understand what that may mean and what that might look like.
Well, Dr. Kaljan, I would like to get your response to that as well, because I think it does speak to the fact that people who have a lot of information and understand the full amount of choices available to them may make different choices than the rest of us. So I'm curious if you feel that having all of the information that you have, do you have enough choices?
I believe I do. And I also know, even from my own experience as a family member in making these kinds of decisions with loved ones, I recognize how painfully difficult these situations are. They require as much from us as we ever have to give. And we have to reach down to our deepest convictions and commitments and struggle in the midst of uncertainty. I think that's one aspect that is so difficult. People don't know what will happen next. I also am humbled and sobered by the fact that if it's that hard for me as a trained medical provider to be a family member at those moments. How hard must it be for family members who don't have professionals in the family?
You know a lot more than most of us do.
But so what I would say is the goals of care are so important. What to try to discern and decide and commit oneself to, what are the most important goals of care, whether it's living longer, reaching a certain functional level, whether it's comfort, at each stage of a disease process, that needs to be discussed. And sadly, practicing medicine is challenging, and time is of the essence. And many of us as medical professionals don't give as much time as we should to these things. So I really encourage your listeners, as patients and as family members of patients, to don't take silence as an answer. If these things need to be discussed, you need to put them on the table as often as you need to do so. And I believe that medical professionals, I trust, will respond to that. But sometimes we need encouragement.
Sue is on the line in Pleasant Hill. Hi, Sue.
Hi. My husband, when we needed hospice, little did we know that we would use it twice, that he would graduate from hospice. And then a few weeks later, his condition declined. And we requested the same incredible staff that would help us for the end of his life. But the thing that we also learned was to never wait until tomorrow what you need to say today. We had an incredible general practitioner who helped us sort everything out and helped us make sure that my husband's final wishes were kept as far as his health care was concerned, and that nothing be done to prolong his life. And furthermore, we learned 10 months later when my father died, that in the very same town of Des Moines, hospices they have different views of how a person should meet the end of life. And we knew what we wanted. My husband died at home. He did not care to go to a comfort house, and he did not care for anything to prolong his life other than enough drugs that he be pain-free. But we learned with my father when the family interviewed other hospice houses and facilities from another provider, that they would take other measures such as IVs to provide fluids. They were very definite in the fact that it's very painful to die and scared my parents to death, and that was unnecessary. Finally, they did choose to use the same provider that we did. And that was my father's wish.
Well, Sue,
so be informed of everything, but make sure your medical team is on board as well.
Sue, thank you very much for bringing that up. And that relates to what we were talking about before with being persistent and asking questions. And Laura, you see a lot of people at this time of life. I think a lot of people are afraid to ask those questions, aren't they?
Yes, and I really appreciated that last caller. I think that it's important to find the right fit, to make sure you get what you need. And really what I like to tell people, they're very nervous to meet with hospice providers. They don't know what the conversation's going to be. And, of course, it seems like the elephant in the room is the death and dying talk. Well, I really like to find out what's going on with them, what matters most to them. It's more about me listening to them and finding out where they're at. And then I like to say that the individual and their family are in the driver's seat.
Well, Lori, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Lori Bishop is Executive Director for Clinical Transformation for Unity Point at Home in Des Moines. Dr. Loris Kaljan, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Kaljan is Director of the Program in Bioethics and Humanities at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine, where he is also a professor in the Department of Internal Medicine. And Peg Sandin, thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for bringing this conversation to Iowa.
Peg Sandin is the executive director of the Death with Dignity National Center in Oregon. Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had technical support today from Ben Stanton. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.